in their memory. And the learning we do should also be in their memory. I also have here a flyer for the summer program for Nishmat. For those who are not familiar, Nishmat is a women's school in Israel for advanced Torah learning, and they do a program every year in Toronto. So they asked me to circulate flyers. It's supposed to be a very high-caliber program, and should be of interest. Okay. Our topic for today is the sandwich generation, which, you know, I find a little bit amusing because we have sandwiches, but okay. Got the joke out of the way. Now we're good. Oh, and there's a sign-in sheet going around. Please do make sure to sign in. There's one there. I have a second one in the event that we run out of room. Okay. The basic challenge that we're looking to discuss in this sandwich generation session is how someone can take care of his or her parents while also raising children. Specific areas that I want to talk about are, first of all, self-care. In terms of looking after yourself when trying to do this, you know, a human being should be more than just the filling in the middle of the sandwich. So that's number one. Number two, economics and the issue of spending on both parents and children. And number three, the big nursing home question. What happens if somebody is not able, as frankly many people are not able, to take care of their parents in their own home, and the parents can't live alone, and the parents say, well, I don't want to be in a nursing home. So at that point, what does someone do? If there's time, there are some other topics I would throw in addition, but I think that will probably take us through our time. And what I want to do is show the way that this is dealt with in Jewish sources, and none of these issues are new, even though people often think of them as new, because in our day, thank God, people live longer. Nonetheless, these are actually very old, well-established issues in Jewish life. Going back to the times of the Talmud, you know, a couple of thousand years ago and more, families tended to live as close units, and elders lived in the home. We find in the Chumash, we find in the basic biblical text, that families are described as ishu beiso, a person and his house, and it was literal. The family actually all lived in the same house. As a matter of fact, if you take a look at source number one, I always find this quote funny. Passage from the Talmud dealing with elders and Amar Chizkiah. Chizkiah is one of the Talmudic sages, not King Chizkiah. Amri Inchi, he said, you know, people say, Sava Bevesa, Pacha Bevesa. If there's an old man in the home, there's a crack in the home. The things are falling apart. Whereas Savta Bevesa, if there's an older woman in the home, Sima Bevesa, there's a treasure in the home. She tends to be more productive and helpful. And yes, the names Saba and Savta that people use, those are Aramaic, and they, you know, as you see here in the Gemara. My point is not to criticize the elderly males, but rather just to note that it was the norm for them to in fact be around the house. That was the way it was done. And the Talmud has many stories of interaction between grown adults and their parents in their home. As a matter of fact, you may be familiar with the practice that I'm seeing breached more and more, but there was a historic Jewish practice of not marrying a spouse who had the same name as your parent. You ever hear of this?
First name.
So that goes back centuries and centuries within Jewish tradition, and one of the standard explanations for the practice, it goes back to a book called Sefer Hasidim, written in Germany in the 13th century. But one of the origins of this is the concern for the honor of the parent who's going to be in the house. Meaning, let's say your mother's name is Rachel, and your spouse's name is Rachel, and you're calling your spouse by name, it's not really respectful towards your mother who's there in the house. Which again reflects the fact that that was the way they lived, with them in the home. And generally speaking, that was the way it was done through the Middle Ages. There could have been help from tzedakah from the outside, philanthropic resources may have helped with it, but fundamentally, while Jewish communities in the Middle Ages had all sorts of philanthropic institutions, you don't find nursing homes at that stage. I brought you a source number two from Salom Baron, the historian, writes, the communal organs or special associations under their supervision extended medical and other assistance to ailing persons at their homes. They would simply live in the house. And that was true until relatively modern times. The Encyclopedia Judaica records the existence of a Jewish nursing home in Amsterdam in 1749. And that, I think, is the oldest record that we have. There's a book by Israel Cohen called The History of Jews in Vilna, which mentions also a nursing home in the 19th century in Lithuania. It was called A Home for the Aged Needy. And there's more you could say about this. But the bottom line is that the problems of dealing with, on the one hand, caring for your children, and on the other hand, caring for the older generation, are not new, and their dilemmas are not new. So the first issue that I said I wanted to address was the issue of self-care. If anyone doesn't have a sheet, there are more, I think, in the middle of the table. The issue of self-care, looking out for yourself. And I've known people who have gone to tremendous lengths. And really, you know, if there were saints in Judaism, like, I would say, oh, apply that word to them. Because of the way that they deny their own needs for the sake of being able to look after their children as well as their parents. But fundamentally, it's a problem. I saw a very interesting source, which I brought here in number three, from Rabbeinu Bachaye in his commentary to the biblical text. As I noted there, Rabbeinu Bachaye is 13th century Spain, not to be confused with Rabbeinu Bachya, who is a few centuries older. But he wrote, regarding the fact that the Torah promises someone who honors his parents, what does the Torah say the reward is going to be?
Long life,
to live a long time. If you take pains to honor your parents, you'll live a long time. So he has a comment, which I found very interesting, that he's actually quoting from Rabbi Sadia Gaon, one of the leading sages of the early 10th century Common Era. He says, "Umashakava hakasuv schara kavod arichus yamim." He says, the text establishes a reward of long life for honoring one's parents. And Rav Sadia Gaon explained, because sometimes parents end up living with their kids for a very long time. And there's a bit of a burden on the kids. And it's difficult for them to properly honor their parents. And honor doesn't simply mean treat them respectfully, but it also implies with it, as the Talmud explains, feeding them, clothing them, taking them out on errands, all of these things, it can be challenging. So therefore, he says, therefore the text says, your reward is that you shall have a long life. That does not mean if you take care of them, then your children will get to do this to you, right? That's part of having a long life. But rather, what it's saying is, you should know that the pains that you are taking on their behalf are also going to contribute to your life. That which you are doing right now for them will be returned in the sense that you will have extra years added on to your life. My point is not necessarily to talk about this reward per se, as much as to show you that Rabbeinu Bachaye in 13th century Spain is alert to the challenge, to the fact that this is difficult for people, and people have difficulty, and they need what we call in Hebrew chizuk. They need strengthening. They need someone to say to them, I recognize what you're going through, and the Torah recognizes what you are going through. It's a very difficult situation. It's a difficult situation for the parents, and it's a difficult, meaning the older generation in this scenario, and it's a difficult situation for their kids. It's a difficult situation for the older generation because people fundamentally want to be independent. And we have all sorts of biblical sources surrounding that, right? The verse in Proverbs, Sone matanot yichyeh, someone who hates gifts will live, is a sentiment many people have, even if they've never read Proverbs. The idea that you don't want to be sustained by the assistance of others. We have a Talmudic passage that says a person prefers one unit of his own produce as opposed to nine units of somebody else's produce. He'd rather have whatever he earned and whatever he personally developed. And for the kids, it's more natural for them to be able to develop their own family as opposed to taking care of their parents. If you take a look at source number four, Rabbi Eliyahu Kramer, better known as the Vilna Gaon, writing in 18th century Lithuania, notes that the very first marriage in the Torah, the marriage of Adam and Eve, of Adam and Chava, is stated in the Torah with the instruction to Adam, v'davak b'ishto, he shall cleave to his wife, he shall stick to his wife. So the Vilna Gaon says, what does that mean, to stick to his wife? Moreh al inyan ba'alut. It means he has to act as a husband. V'lo ma'aseh ishut. It's not a reference to procreation. That's not what it means. Rather, shekol yamav yetoreach va'amel al parnasasah, that he should spend his days straining to support her, working to support her, and not his father and mother. The idea is that he leaves that behind, and now he's going to take care of his family that he is creating. And so it is challenging for people to have to split their focus between them. And because of that, it's really important that that people look out for themselves. The Torah says, "V'nishmartem ma'ol nafshoseichem." You have to guard your life. That is a mitzvah. Aside from the fact that you're not going to be any good to your children and to your parents if you don't look after yourself. I brought you a source here, source number 5, Rabbi Lazar Papo. He was a rabbi in 18th to 19th century Bulgaria. It wasn't known as Bulgaria in those days. In those days, it was part of the Ottoman Empire. Today, it would be Bulgaria. But he wrote a work called Pele Yoetz, which discusses primarily ethical issues within Torah, but also issues of Jewish law. And under the entry called Chesed, Chesed means kindness, generosity, right? So under that heading, he makes an important point in source number 5. Ubiyoser v'yoser yigdal hachiyuv asos chesed im atzmo v'gufo. He says, even greater, and really my translation into the English doesn't carry the strength of it. He says, "Bioser ubioser," more and more, even more than his obligation of help for others. Hachiyuv asos chesed im atzmo begufo is the obligation to perform chesed, to take care of himself, his own body. And he quotes a verse from Mishlei, from Proverbs, "Begomel nafsho ish chesed," one who gives to himself is a person of chesed. Ukamosha Amru al Hillel HaZaken, and they tell the story of the great sage Hillel, Shekeshaya Holech Le'achol, when he would go eat. Haya Omer, Elech Ve'egmol Chesed Imachsanya Sheyeshli. Dahainu Nishma, so he would say, I'm going to now go perform Chesed with my host, or my guest, I should say, which is his soul. So he would view that as an act of Chesed. Eating, don't think of it as an indulgence, don't feel guilty, right? Eating is taking care of my soul. That's what I'm doing. So this idea is, I think, a fundamental idea, and I say it even though it's obvious, and I think people are aware that they have a responsibility to look after themselves, because even though people know it, they don't do it in practice. I can't tell you how many times over the years, I spent 12 years in the synagogue rabbinate. I can't tell you how many times over the years there would be someone who had a relative in the hospital, and they would be sleeping over in the hospital and constantly there and ignoring everything about their personal care and everything about their jobs and everything else. And it's an admirable instinct, and it's an important instinct. Unfortunately, it's also self-destructive. And that's why I wanted to make sure not only to say that it's necessary, but to ground it in sources from Torah, from our tradition, to show that this is a classic and fundamental part of the Jewish outlook on the challenges that we're discussing. So that brings me to our next point, which is economics and the question of prioritizing spending for one's parents versus spending for one's children. And I'll give you the case. Janet and Jim have 3 children who go to yeshiva, middle school, high school, whatever age you want to put on it. The bottom line is tuition is way high. Let's say they're spending $60,000 a year, and that is a conservative number for those paying tuition. You know what I'm talking about. So they're spending $60,000 a year on that. At the same time, Jim's parents need 24-hour care. Also very expensive. And I don't know the nuances within OHIP of what will be covered by the government and what will be not. So I'm seeing head shaking. The answer is they're not. Okay. So that answers my question. I came in from the U.S., and therefore I can give you the same answer for what's going to be taken care of. So they're finding that between these two costs, they can't make ends meet. So the question is this. Do they apply for scholarship from the school for their child's education? If they're denied scholarship for whatever reason, the funds aren't there or whatever it is, do they say, then let me pull my child out because I need to be able to take care of my parents. What would you say?
I think they should apply for the subsidy.
Okay, they apply. Let's say they apply.
Because the first thing that has to happen for anything is help.
Mm-hmm.
So before you, no one says that you have to pay a school to teach your child. That responsibility primarily rests firstly on the parent. So you would think that first you should take care of the help. Then you go to the next step.
But if they're not teaching their child, right? If they're not teaching them, then they do have an obligation to hire someone to do it. Unless you're saying that along with the taking care of the parents, they should also then homeschool the child.
That would be the first option. Now, let's talk about someone who isn't capable. Myself, I wouldn't be capable. So then I would have to go and ask from the community to, and help them about my problem and see if I could get some help. And then we're in this cutoff problem, like, how much can I get help, and how can you do it?
Right.
That's the jeopardy of the middle class in, right, in Greater Toronto.
Excuse me, I'm not condoning this, but a matter of observation seen in Europe, where there are many people who send their kids to public school because they have no other option, and in the evening they go to a Tomatora.
Mm-hmm.
And works out, I have to say it's much cheaper, but it has been done, and I know people who came out of the system, they came out fine. I'm not saying that this is something which we have to resort to in North America.
Right, so. And it's important to know. The day school, as important as it is not the only option on the table. Of course, you know, when someone says, and I can echo it, that I know people who went through Hebrew school systems and came out fine. I also know people who went through Hebrew schools and didn't come out fine. And I know people who went to day schools and didn't come out fine. I think the percentages are higher on behalf of the day school. You could argue as to why that is. You know, there are many, you know, the correlation versus causation. My point isn't to really get into that discussion. But yes, that's an option that's theoretically at least on the table.
So everyone's looking at saving money on the children's side with their education. I mean, the younger person in the room, but what about saving money on the parent's side? Maybe the middle generation can stay home and take care of the parents so that you're not spending out on how much it is for full-time care.
Mm-hmm. So maybe the answer is finding ways to take away some of the costs of the 24-hour care.
Mm-hmm.
Could be. There may also be, we should add, resources within the community that can help in terms of funding the 24-hour care. In other words, there are stuck up funds in the community. Maybe that's what, and I don't mean now, I'm not even talking about the greater, you know, human community. I'm talking about just within the Jewish community. There are funds that may be able to be drawn on for assistance. So then the question is, so which fund do I go to? Do I go to the school for the scholarship, or to go to the rabbi's discretionary fund for the 24-hour care? Neither institution is going to be happy with me recommending them. Yes.
To put your question, make it more stark, let's take away all the outside forces and just say that it really is a choice between, let's forget even educating your kids. Let's say it's the difference between, when it comes to care, feeding your kids or feeding your parents. Let's say we're really in that tight spot. There are no other funds.
Right?
Then what does the question become? Then you have a real dilemma. Then you're really going to have an either or. You can't do it halfway.
Right.
Okay? In that case, the question is, where does the obligation primarily fall? And it's there is no good answer. But I'm looking at it just from the perspective of, we have, in terms of, we're talking bare necessities.
Right.
In terms of feeding the kids, there is no other responsibility, meaning it's your primary responsibility for your children.
Right, so that's where I want to go with this, is the question of, so where is my primary responsibility? Exactly that question. But you're right. I mean, I created this because I wanted it to fit sort of more of the scenario that we see in the community in terms of the other funds that exist and the options that are out there. But it's for sure true. I had a conversation with somebody just last week or the week before, you know, whose child is now reaching the age of bar mitzvah. And he said, like, we don't do gefilte fish on Shabbos. Because we want to be able to, you know, to send the kids to school, but now he doesn't know how he's going to make a bar mitzvah, even just like something basic. Like, people, you know, these are very real practical questions. Frankly, even without the complication of the parents, just the general tuition and so on. But when you add in the parents, now that adds this whole other layer, because it's not even a question of of, you know, am I saving something or storing something? I have an obligation on this side, I have an obligation on that side. Now what do I do? So the first thing to realize is that this isn't new. Yes?
I think that the social welfare system in the province of Ontario, I think, would be more sympathetic to aging parents than to a family supporting kids. I believe that to be the case. I may be wrong, but there are social welfare programs that do support elderly people, community and social services, and other programs. Not that they're so great, because they're not, and it would still require funds and input from the individual families. But at least it does exist. Where it doesn't exist, you know, thanks to our Ministry of Education here, and there is no support for Jewish education unless you sort of tap into the heritage language programs that that provide some benefit.
Right. I mean, I will say, just because I feel like I have to make a point, there is, in the sense that when people donate to a school, they get various charitable deductions for their taxes, which, again, coming in from the United States, the system is not as generous in most states in terms of the deductions that you get for doing it. And deductions from tuition is primarily what I'm thinking of. So I don't want to be ungrateful to the system for what they do, but yes, they certainly there's more we would want to see. That's for sure. Thank you.
There's limitations on the deduction that you're getting personally, which is basically to allow you for the Hebrew studies, but not for the general studies.
Right, the Hebrew studies, the daycare, the absolutely understood. I forgot for a moment. I'm sitting in an accounting firm. Asking for trouble by opening my mouth. Okay. But this is not a new issue. Take a look at well, first of all, the case that I did not bring on this, I realize now why I did it. I wanted to, but all right. There's a passage in the Talmud Yerushalmi, in the volume called Peah, which actually deals with this. So you're talking about a case now going back a couple of thousand years of someone saying, I have to choose between my children and my parents, and I don't know what to do. Take a look at source number 6, the case I did bring, Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Adaret in 13th century Spain. I didn't bring you his answer. I just brought you his question. Sha'alda, he was approached by somebody who asked him. Reuven complained against his son Chanoch in court, in rabbinical courts, saying he should be paying for my food. He should be supporting me. And Chanoch, the son, says, well, I have kids of my own. I need to support them. And he says, by the way, you know, my father has accounts receivable. He has people who owe him money. Let him get that and use that for his support. And the father says, you know, this is in doubt. I don't know whether I'm ever going to be able to collect on these things. And he says he's going to die of starvation before he can ever get them. So this is not a new issue. 13th century Spain, you're seeing this debated. And again, as I said, it goes back actually to Talmudic times. So what do we say? So the truth of the matter is that when we talk about caring for one's parents, there are multiple obligations. One obligation is the honor your parents obligation. Separate from that, there's the mitzvah of Hadarta Pnei Zaken, right? Honoring the elderly. And the general issue of Kavod HaBriot, of human dignity, and the importance of preserving that, and making sure to preserve their dignity, even if they weren't related to you at all. However, the fundamental principle is that when you're dealing with honoring one's parents, parents do not have a lien on their child's assets. They're not able to say, we have a right to whatever our children own. And I brought you the source for this, source number 7, where the Talmud asks this question of who exactly is responsible to fund the honor one gives to one's parents. The Talmud asked, Mishal mi, whose property should be used in order to take care of the parents? Rav Yehuda Amar Mishal ben. Rav Yehuda said, the child. Rabbi Nassan, and when it says son, don't get hung up on that. It is indeed child. It's just that we don't have a gender-neutral word to use, but it's actually the child. Rav Nassan bar Oshia Amar Mishel Av. Rav Nassan bar Oshia says, no, it's the father. And once again, it's the parent. It's not father-specific. It's father and mother. Oru le Rabbanan le Rav Yirmiya, va'amri la lebreid Rav Yirmiya, keman damar Mishel Av. The sages ruled, in fact, that it is the parent's funds. It comes from the parent. And if you take a look at source number 8, you see how Maimonides codifies it. He says, Mishel Av, it does come from the parents. The parents' funds are the ones that are supposed to be drawn on. However, he then writes, V'im ein mamon la'av, v'yesh mamon la'ben, if the parent doesn't have the money, and the child has the money, kofin oso v'zan aviv v'imo k'fi mashu yachol, then we force him to feed them as he is able. However, the question is, under what heading is it that we are forcing them to do this? Under what principle is it? If you're telling me the obligation is on the parents' funds, then why are we forcing them to do it? Just pass over the sign G. Thanks. Under what heading does this come? You follow what I'm asking? If you just told me that it's the parents' assets, then in the absence of the parents' assets, why am I compelling the child? What's the basis for it?
I'll complete both scenarios. So the parents have no assets in this scenario, right? That's what they need.
Correct.
So there are no assets there.
Correct.
So then you're looking at where are their assets. Where are their assets? The son has assets.
Yeah,
they're gone.
What if the son doesn't have assets?
Right, we're dealing with where he does in this particular case. And I'm going to come back to your question because it's going to be the answer to this also. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. The parents don't have because they spent it all. Whatever they spent it on, at this point, doesn't matter. We're saying we're going to compel the son. But you just told me that the son doesn't have an obligation to spend his own. So on what basis are we compelling? So take a look, please, at the flip side of the sheet, source number 9. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. This will give us the clue. This obligation of feeding one's parents, Mishel Av Ve'im, is out of the parents' property. Im Yeshla, assuming they have. Vim Ein La'av, V'Yeshla Ben, if the father does not have, but the son has, Kofin Oso V'Zan Aviv Kifi Mashu Yachol, then we force the child to feed the parent to the extent that he is able. And that is mirroring what Maimonides said. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, is quoting Maimonides verbatim. But then he writes, Vim Ein Laben, then what do I do if the child doesn't have? Eino Chayev Lachzer Al Hapsachim Ha'achiles Aviv. We don't obligate him to go now and search for tzedakah, for assistance from the outside. We're not going to make him literally beg at people's doors, as the line goes here, in order to feed his father. So what is going to happen? If there are no assets in the family whatsoever, and we're not going to have the son go out and seek donations, so is the father going to die of starvation? What other option is there? The father goes to receive tzedakah, correct. That the father will go out and apply for whatever assistance he can apply for. Rabbi Moshe Isserles writes, known as Rama, in Krakow in the 16th century, the second part of this source. Some say that the child is not obligated to give beyond his tzedakah obligation. Right? We know that one is required to give meiser, he's required to give 10% of his income in support of the needy. So that's what his requirement is going to be, 10%. But then he says, if the child has assets, he has the means to support, a curse upon somebody who uses his tzedakah funds to support his parent. And now I think we may have a broader understanding of what's going on here. Let me spell it out.
Is that talking about the miser? Is that talking yes. about what you're asking?
No, his own miser. You're right. It's about his own miser. What we're really saying here is that the obligation is on the parent's funds. If the parent doesn't have, the child can choose to spend his own. And we can compel him if he doesn't choose to spend his own. If we compel him, it's under the tzedaka heading. Because there is a basic rule, which is that if people in the community are not giving the way that they are supposed to give, rabbinical courts of old had the power to actually say to them, you're giving anyway. And they could even seize a person's assets in order to make that person give tzedakah. That power actually exists. Existed, anyway. Today it exists in the hands of the UJA. No, the statement that is being made here in the Shulchan Aruch and the Code of Jewish Law, building off of what Maimonides said, is you can compel the child to give to tzedakah based on his obligation to give. I'm sorry, to give to support the parent because of his obligation to give to tzedakah, just like anybody else has an obligation to give. Except that when it comes to the laws of tzedakah and philanthropy, we have a rule which is family first. So therefore, the child has the first obligation to donate to support the parents. So we're going to have the child do it. And Rabbi Isserlis then adds, he says, that's just wrong. If he's going to use money that he is supposed to be giving philanthropically, he's going to use that for his parents. He should view that as an obligation that comes even before that. He shouldn't be using it for it. But the point is that indeed the parents have a claim on his tzedakah money. So what emerges from this is parents do not have a lien on their child's assets. The child's obligation of feeding the parent does not mean the child now goes out shopping and with his own funds does it. It means the child goes out shopping using the parent's bank account. The child is still obligated to do the work, but the money comes from the parent. That's the idea. Hold on 1 second. And then in the event that the parents don't have, then the child can, if need be, consider it tzedakah to help. Frankly, we would hope that they wouldn't. But that's the idea. We haven't yet addressed the case in which the child can't afford both his children and his parents. That's coming next. Yes?
The quote here is that one who uses his 10% allotments of tzedakah to support his parents is cursed. One who at least has sufficient funds to do otherwise.
Yeah.
But what about someone who... What about a parent who uses other people's tzedakah when the child can support the parent? I mean, the child isn't using either, but the parent is choosing to use tzedakah rather than the child insisting, hey, don't do that.
You know, right.
Would a similar curse apply?
Well, the parent.
The child rather than
the child is an adult child. We're talking.
Yes, adult child who has a sufficient amount of money.
Yeah.
To support the parents. The parents do not.
Yeah.
The parent, rather than going to the child, go and get tzedakah.
Right.
The child does not use either his remaining assets nor his 10% allotment to support his parents. Would a similar curse, would that apply as here?
So the Talmud actually talks about someone who has means and yet draws on communal tzedakah, and it's not friendly to such a person. And I think that's what you would apply, assuming that it's willful. In other words, that the parent is saying, "I could, but I don't want
to
do it."
It's not alluded to in Gemara, so this I think is wrong.
Yes, that's where it is.
That one appeals to the tzedakah when he doesn't need it. He won't finish his days until he has to ask.
That he really will need it. Yes, that's the passage I was thinking of. Thank you. So, let's move to the case now where you have the person who's stuck in the middle. What do I do? I've got children and I've got parents. What am I supposed to do? So, take a look at source number 10. Rabbi Isserlis, in this Code of Jewish Law, writes, "Parnasas atzmo kodamas l'chol adam." First of all, supporting yourself comes first. You have to make sure you can eat. "Ve'achar kach yakdim parnasas aviv v'imo im heim aniyim." Then he should give precedence to his parents' support if they are needy. "Ve'heim kodmim l'parnasas banav." And supporting the parents precedes supporting one's children. However, just wait a second. Take a look at source number 11, and you see a very important caveat that I wouldn't have known from reading the text alone. Rabbi Kalfan Moshe HaKohen, a major authority in Jewish law, as you see in Tunisia, the island of Djerba, going back to the early 20th century, writes, that's talking about children who are already of age for independence. Now, the age of independence may change based on your society. I think that, you know, at this point we're like 25, 26. Whereas in the days of the Shah writing in the 17th century, he put the age of independence at the age of 6. Because children would be apprenticed out and they would get jobs. And yeah, so there's been some change in that regard, largely because of the innovation of graduate school. But if you take a look at Rabbi Chava Moshe Cohen, he says, Yesh lo banim ketanim, if he has small children, hatzarech lazunam, he has to feed, ein tan aso klum, then saying the parents' claim of I deserve this is actually nothing. It doesn't supersede. So the upshot of this is that first, it's the parents' money. That's clear. If the parents have assets, theirs should be used to take care of themselves. In the event that they don't have the ability, then if one's children are already of the age of independence, then you take care of the parents first, ideally not via tzedakah, ideally via your own assets. However, in the event that that your own children are minors, and I say minors, I don't mean under the age of 18, I mean under the age of whatever is considered normal for independence, then your first obligation is indeed for the children's support. Now, that doesn't necessarily really answer the tuition question. And the reason it doesn't is because the sources that we just saw that dealt with this, numbers 10 and 11, were talking about support as in food. And as Fred pointed out, maybe we distinguish between food and tuition. So that's a harder nut to crack in terms of how we look at it. It seems to me that one would still have the obligation to pay the tuition first. It seems to me that one would still have the obligation to pay the tuition before taking care of the parents and use the communal philanthropy for the parent. And my basis for saying that is that the obligation for tuition for one's children is a personal one. There is an obligation for parents to give their child a Jewish education, whereas the obligation for one's parents is this broader tzedakah obligation, which is a communal obligation. So on that basis, I would argue that that he should pay the tuition first and then look after them, with the important caveat that if they were in a real situation of starvation and need, I think that might change the calculation because of the dire nature of what they're looking at. Yes.
What about our children's obligations? I'm saying that is, I'm not talking about the 8-year-old and 10-year-old in Peter. I'm talking about the 20-year-old in university or in yeshiva. And there are many kids in our greater community who don't work part-time, who don't work in the summer, and they may have a family situation. I do know kids who really work hard to help their family, even contribute money to their family. So there's sort of like a cutoff line in my mind where that you have certain responsibilities for their tuition, there's certain responsibilities to your children, but there's a certain age point. And as you were referring, it used to be the age of 6.
Right.
Right? Your kid's 18 years old. I mean, please, don't tell me they can't go get a part-time job in the coffee shop and contribute to help so that they can help themselves and that you can help your parents.
Right, and I think you're right. All other things being equal, meaning that it's a job market where jobs are available, and you know, as you said, I mean, it doesn't have to be some grand job. You know, it's just something to bring in some income. Then I think that's the point that Rabbi Chalfon HaKohen is making in source number 11, when he makes that distinction between children who are not of age of independence versus children who are. It's a little bit fuzzy in terms of the line. But the answer may well be whatever is the norm in society for someone to go out and get a part-time job. You know, that varies a little bit by the job. But, you know, people can mow lawns. People can work in the coffee shop. Like, there are opportunities out there. Then I think you're right. At that point, there is a responsibility for them to play a role. Okay. That brings us to the nursing home question. The question of, and I'm giving a narrow case, it's a broad issue, but you know, this is a lunchtime thing and we can't deal with everything. But the case of somebody who has the parents' at home. The parents need the care. They can't live independently. That's not part of this scenario. So they have the option of taking the parent into their home. They have the option of the nursing home. They say, I can't manage to take care of my parents at home while I'm raising my children. I just can't do it. The parent says, I don't want to go to the nursing home. So what are you supposed to do? Let's take a look at some sources. We do recognize that it is not something people want to do. Leaving one's surroundings, leaving that which is familiar, to go be in some new facility, even if they're going to provide better care, no one wants to leave their natural surroundings. We find that in Tanakh, in the story of Barzillai, who is invited by King David to live in Jerusalem, and King David is going to support him, and he says, you know what, I'm 80 years old already, I'd rather just be in the place that's familiar to me. Even though the king has summoned him and said, I'm going to take care of you, he says, I'd rather stay home. That's a passage, it's in Shmuel Bet, for those who would like to look it up, the 19th chapter, it's explained in the Gemara at the end of Shabbos. Source number 12 deals with a practical case. The mayor of Rothenburg in 14th century Germany was asked about a situation in which two widows had made an agreement with each other. The widows are Rachel and Leah. And the deal they made between themselves was that Rachel was going to pay Leah money now in exchange for Leah supporting her later on when she would live in Rachel's home. Okay, so let's make sure that's clear. Rachel makes a payment to Leah now, with the idea that years later, when she needs it, Leah will take her in and support her in her own, in Leah's home. In the interim between the time that Rachel pays Leah and the time that Rachel wants to call in the debt, so to speak, Leah moves overseas. And she says, well, if you want me to support you, I'm willing to do it, but you have to come here. Rachel argues that wasn't part of the agreement, and I paid you. You have to come back here. So Rabbi Rothenberg, as he presents it, notes in source number 12, Rachel yechola lomar al das sheitzemi mekomi umiti rasilo ala al daiti. It never entered my mind, Rachel can say, that I would have to leave my place, that I have to leave my town to go live in this other place, this village, below Menyan, below Tefillah, doesn't have shul, it doesn't have prayer. He says, would she ever have expected that she'd have to go, overseas to go live with her? And what would your boundary then be? If you're going to say that that's true, is there any point at which you're willing to say this was not what was expected? It's a difficult question. I bring it just to show you, once again, the issue of being in unfamiliar surroundings is not new. This is a very old problem. Generally speaking, the Torah's sources, as expressed in the Talmud and in later authorities, are that one who finds he can't handle the needs of the patient does indeed say, let me get somebody else to take care of them, and is within their rights to do so. There's a classic story in the Talmud, I brought it here in source number 13. In the interest of time, I'll say it outside of the text, but it's involving Rav Asi. Rav Asi has an elderly mother. And she says to him, I want jewelry. And he says, okay. Makes her jewelry. She says, I'd like to find a husband. I'll go look. She says, no, I want one like you. That's what he says. And at that point, he says, all right, I can't deal with this. And he leaves her, and he makes aliyah. He goes to Israel. Then he gets word that she is coming to find him. And he asks his rabbi, his teacher, Rabbi Yochanan, do I leave Israel to go to her? And Rabbi Yochanan replied, no. Well, what about greeting my mother? I don't know. Delays for a little bit, and then he comes back to Rabbi Yochanan, and Rabbi Yochanan says, you know what? Go. You want to go? So go. And as the story develops, he hears that his mother has already passed away. And he says, Iyadi lo nafki. Had I known, I would not have left. Which is vague. How would you explain those words? Had I known, I would not have left.
He would have stayed home, because he ran away because she was giving him a huge headache.
Possibly. But one way to interpret it is, had I known that this was going to happen with her, I would not have left to go to Israel in the first place. Mm-hmm. What's the other way to read it? Yeah, I wouldn't have left Israel to go back if I had known that she was already going to be dead by the time I arrived. There are two different ways you could read it. It's vague. But Rav Asi, unquestionably in this story, leaves town because he can't handle whatever it is that's going on. And I don't know. We're not given enough detail to know what exactly it is that's motivating him. Is it the headache? Is it that this is meant to represent dementia? There's something going on, and he's not able to take care of her. It's really not clear in the story. But take a look at source number 14, where Rambam Maimonides codifies this as law. He says, "Mishe nitrafa daito shel avivo shel imo." If a person's father or mother develops dementia, tiruv hadat literally means a torn up mind. They've lost capacity. So he should try to act according to their wishes, taking care of them until God has mercy on them. And you know what he means when he says God has mercy on them. But if he can't do it, because they've simply become too irrational and he can't take care of them, so let him leave. He should instruct others to take care of them. Hire somebody to do the job. Now, it's interesting to note, where is this care going to take place?
In their house, so he should leave.
Right. In home. Now, keep in mind, Jewish communities, again, as I said at the outset, didn't have the nursing home facility in those days. But the idea is that they're staying home, and he has to go find some other place to be. They should be where it's familiar. And he should hire somebody else. Rivet, who wrote the standard commentary to Maimonides, says, I don't understand. If he's going to leave, who's he going to find to take care of them? Right? To which the answer may be professionals, which Rivet may not be familiar with, and that's why he says who's going to be the one to do the job. There's more to say on that disagreement. But fundamentally, the Code of Jewish Law sides with Rambam, sides with Maimonides, and that he is responsible to hire somebody else. That's what he does. And this is indeed the justification for saying, at a certain point, I can't manage their care, whether that's physical or psychological. And so I need to put someone else in charge. Presumably, Rambam's understanding is that that's what Rav Asi did. Rav Asi did not simply abdicate, but he left somebody to take care of them. That's the assumption. Well, what if they refuse? So Rabbi Yigal Shaffrin wrote an article in a journal called Tchumin. It's, I think, about 20 years ago at this point, in which he pointed out that the obligation to save lives applies even to somebody who wants to end his own life. In other words, I have, within Judaism, a duty to rescue. If somebody is in danger, I have to save them. What about the person who is jumping off the bridge? And he says, I don't want you to save me. Do I still have a duty to rescue? Mm-hmm. Yes, I still have a duty to rescue. What if the person is entirely sane? He knows exactly what he's doing. He's not suffering from depression. He's made a calculation that this is what's best for him. Then what? Right. So that raises complications in terms of physician-assisted suicide and so on. Discuss that in other sessions. But the fundamental view that Rabbi Shaffrin expresses is that I have an obligation to help them. And therefore, if the parent says, I don't want to go into the nursing home, but you can't take care of them where they are, then they are equivalent to the person who says, I don't care, it doesn't matter, I'd rather die. And the answer is no. You're not allowed to do that. You can't listen, he writes. And he says, obviously we have to be very careful about how it's handled, to do it in a way that takes their needs into consideration to the maximum, not to frighten them, not to upset them. But at the same time, realistically, that's what one would do. Yes, Fred.
So is the overriding provision there is that you yourself, person who's caring for the elderly are getting sick. You're not just sleeping 2 hours a night. The parent, it could be a child, needs 24-hour care.
Right.
So you're not physically taking care of yourself, so your health continues to decline. They may not like the situation. They may not want to live. They may want to live in their home the rest of their life, or they may not want a caregiver in the home, or they may not want to go to these places. But there comes a point that you, from what I've seen here earlier on, you still have this important concept that you have to care for yourself. So again, we get into this issue of a cutoff line. How much should you suffer,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
Because you have a certain obligation, and then it comes to a point that no, if the you have this obligation, but you shouldn't be. There's a point where you're over the hill, where you're personally becoming ill. And I'm not talking about catching a cold, but you're ill. You're not taking your health. You have to go to the doctor. You personally should be going to a hospital, or maybe you should be in care. Like, if it gets to that point, then you may not be able to service the wishes of your parents.
Correct. And that's what we're talking about. When you say there is a limit, I can't take care of them properly and take care of myself properly, then yes, that's where we draw the line. And I'm going to go one step further, just a second, and then take more questions on it. But one of the questions that has been asked in modern times is, what if I can manage their needs, but not respectfully? Meaning that they're going to either emotionally, I'm going to become so aggravated that I'm going to lash out at some point, right? I'm going to yell, I'm going to whatever, it's not going to be respectful for them. Or physically I can't. One of the questions that I've seen discussed, I think it was to Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, the question was asked, in order to be able to feed them, I need to restrain them. Right? They have to be belted into a chair. They have to have their arms tied to whatever it is in order to be able to feed them. Whereas if they were in a facility, you have professionals who can manage this and can do this properly and respectfully. What do I do? So there, the view brought by halachic authorities on this, Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein, his Chashuk Echemed, the Yalkut Yosef, they say that is grounds to put them into the nursing home. Actually, the Chashuk Echemed is a little bit fuzzy. I shouldn't say that. He says something very interesting. He points out a law from the Code of Jewish Law. The rule is when it comes to lending money, the Torah says lo si lo kinoshe, which means that if I lend someone money and he owes me the debt, but I know he lacks the means to pay, I'm not allowed to conduct myself in front of him as a creditor. Meaning, I can't go to him and make his life miserable. I'm not even supposed to walk in front of him if I can avoid it, lest it make him upset, because he knows every time he sees me that he owes me money. The Torah is very concerned about his emotional state. So the Code of Jewish Law asks, what if you know someone's asking you for money, and you know he doesn't pay his debts on time, and you know yourself, and you know that you're going to end up becoming a noshe. You will end up acting as a creditor to him, violating the law. And the Code of Jewish Law says, then don't lend him. Better that than put yourself in a position where you're going to violate the law. So Rabbi Zilberstein says, well, maybe the same thing is true here. You're taking care of them in your home, but you're going to violate their dignity in caring for them. Then he backs off of that. And he says, well, that may be different. Lending to him is an optional thing. Taking care of your parents is an obligation. So keep them in the home and just, you know, do the best that you can with the situation. That's actually his conclusion. However, Yalkut Yosef and others disagree and say no. They say better to send them into a nursing home. And here I brought you one quote from Rabbi Zilberstein. He was dealing with a separate case. I brought you a quote that wasn't the quote that I wanted. But the upshot of what he says here and the upshot of the position of Yalkut Yosef and others is that fundamentally you do reach a point where the place where they belong is a nursing home. That's where they're able to be cared for properly. And at that point, that's the appropriate thing to do. There's always more we can say, but I'm going to pause my words there and open it for questions. And if anyone has to go, you know, understood, and I'm not insulted. Please do make sure though that you signed in for this. Yes, Janice.
It's a twofold thing. First of all, if when you're talking about the hard done by child and who has to deal, you know, with the dilemma of the family and his family and the parents. But then once there are other siblings, but it usually always falls on one child. There could be many siblings, and they may be living their lives very, very well and normally with their families, and then the onus and all the responsibilities and all the headaches and the marital strife,
yep.
and the family dynamic in that particular family is a mess.
Right.
No, that's the one part. But then what about the other part?
Yes.
Is that perhaps the son or the daughter who's doing this has made a unilateral choice that this is what they want to do, and so that they're perhaps refusing the help of their siblings, but also using their wives and children as their shadow to help in this pursuit, when really it's a unilateral decision. It's not a husband and wife decision.
Right. So this is a very good question. That was actually what I had next in my notes, and I said I'll stop short of, but I'll just say briefly. Number one of the things that I always advise people to do when they were dealing with the situation of an elderly parent was that all the siblings get together on a regular basis to discuss how they're managing things and how they're sharing things. Because even that which one decides now, 6 months from now, they may not feel the same. They may be starting to feel bitter. I'm taking more than my share. You live far away, so you don't even know what's going on. You insist on having input in the decisions, and so on and so forth. All the different crises that come up. So I think having them discuss regularly, you know, if they can't meet in person, then by phone, whatever it is, but they need to make sure that they're meeting and discussing to the extent they can. In terms of who is supposed to take care of this, the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, interestingly puts the first obligation on males, the son, and unmarried females. So if they have a son or they have a daughter who is still single, those are the ones who are supposed to do it first. And the reason is, because when a man and woman get married, the male pledges, and it's in the ketubah, that he's going to fund his wife's existence. He's going to feed her. He's going to get shelter for her. He's going to provide clothing for her. He will honor her and so forth. And her obligation in response is supposed to be, and I know that this runs into political correctness issues, but I'm telling you, from a Talmudic standpoint, what she's going to do is take the means that he is providing and use them to construct a household. That was the framework. That does not mean that women can't go out and get a job. That does not mean that all the males necessarily are going to be outside of the house and take no responsibility for the home. That's not my point. My point in saying it is that the classic understanding was that that was what your household looked like, and therefore the Code of Jewish Law says you can't obligate their married daughter to take care of them because she's already taking care of the household for her family. So let the man, when he's...
Also.
But in those days, they did have they had means potentially still.
The wife doesn't have any means. She's relying on the husband to give her money, so she has no means to do it.
Right. So what I'm saying is that's not entirely so. Meaning you find plenty of accounts and discussion of it in the Talmud of women having their own means, whether they got it by a gift that was given to them from their parents, or whether they were working as they did in Talmudic times. You find women working regularly through it. I don't want to digress too much, but the point is that the woman in this case has this one household to set up. Better let the husband, when he's not working for support of his family, let him then go and support the parents, or the unmarried daughter would support them. That's the way that the Code of Jewish Law suggests. It's not, that doesn't mean that that's now the obligation for the way they're going to do it. The other note Rabbi Moshe Isserlis makes in this is that when it comes to financial support, they should divide it up based on the means of the children. It's not, you know, one child, one vote. You have five children, so they each get 20%. But you look at it and say, you know, this one has five kids and needs to support them. This one, yeah, their kids are already grown up and independent and hopefully working and so forth, and less of an obligation for the parents. Whatever it is, it has to be based on the means of the children and have them divide up among themselves. But yeah, this is a classic problem. And in terms of the other question that you had, the question of what about where this fellow has said, I'm going to do it, and he has put his family out for it, that's actually much discussed going back to the times of the Rambam, of Maimonides. He has a discussion about this. He deals with a case in which the man says, I want to take my parents into my home, and his wife says, nothing doing. I don't like them, or it's making me miserable, or vice versa, where the wife says, I want to take them in, and the husband says no, and the answer is, the spouses have a veto option. They can say, no, that wasn't the deal when we got married. You can't compel me to live with them. There's some discussion about whichever one owns the home has, so to speak, first say. The other spouse, if the one who's not the owner of the home says, I can't deal with this, then they go to a Beit Din, they go to a rabbinical court, they substantiate what they're saying by explaining what it is about the parents that they can't deal with. The court says, okay, we accept your testimony, and then again, they won't be brought into the home. So they have from the standpoint of Jewish law, they have veto power. Mind you, people who are dealing with this, if they end up resorting to a veto power, are going to have more problems down the road. Like, they need to figure this out. But that's the, in a nutshell, response.
Sources talk about whether you have the means, but how do you know this unless you're independently wealthy, really wealthy? How do you know if you have the means? You're planning for your future, and if you have, or because of the fact that you've been honoring your parents, you don't necessarily know whether you have the means.
Right. So this is a broad question within Jewish law in general. You know, how does long-term planning work? Do we take that into consideration, or do we say, look at what's in front of you right now? I'm not sure. I want to look into it a little bit, and then what I'll do is send an email out to the email list of people who signed in for the class. There's an incentive for signing in, because I'm not sure how to address it. My gut is to say that in general, in Judaism, the view is that you look at what's in front of you right now, rather than saying, well, I can't spend on this now because 10 years from now I may have greater needs. But I want to look into it.
Rely on community support.
Right.
If that's the prevailing opinion, and you're supposed to, utilize all your assets, until they're gone.
Right. Then yes, you will end up relying on the community. That is correct. I understand the problem, but I suspect that's the way we go. But again, I want to look it up before I give that as an answer.
Sorry, I interrupted you inadvertently. What about the concept of a chacham, a barosha, a person, see, the head of a situation? He knows that something is going to work out. Now, can you say that's not really a halachic dictum? It's really, it's something which depends on the individual. It might be correct. How would you take that into account, if at all?
So, it is certainly our responsibility to plan ahead. But for every verse about planning ahead, I will show you five or six that talk about trusting in God, and, it's not simple and straightforward. I think to a certain extent it also depends on the level of need you're talking about. In other words, it's one thing for me to say, I need to make a decision about whether they get this level of care or that level of care, and therefore I want to calculate my needs 10 years from now or 5 years from now. It's another thing if they don't have adequate care for their needs right now, I think it's fairly clear that I don't have the option of saying, well, 10 years from now I need these funds. So I think that to a certain extent it's going to be based on the level of need on both sides of the equation. But again, I want to think about this. I think I need to do some research in order to provide a stronger answer. Fred?
You covered it. It's a tough dynamic.
Yeah.
Going into the good end, because with that, you think about yourself, what happens if you're especially not child,
yep.
Especially grandchild, I don't know, there's lots of dynamics.
Right.
And just as it touches on one of the previous sessions that we had that talked about inheritance and whether a parent does have an obligation to leave anything over for his kids.
Right.
In which case, I think we sort of said that, we don't have an obligation to leave anything over, and therefore...
Yep. More or less.
It plays into your planning, where your long-term planning, where a lot of people try planning for an inheritance for their kids. Really, that shouldn't be part of your calculation.
Well, if the parent has said, I am planning on doing this, and they have reason to believe that they're people of their word, and that they have reason to believe that it's actually going to be there when the time comes, the challenge is, aside from the general ghoulish morbidity of that kind of a calculation, you don't know what the time frame is.
With insurance, life insurance policies,
right.
Where, do I continue making an exorbitant amount of insurance premiums at a later age? To be able to leave something over, or
right.
Use that funds to care for my parents.
Right. Now, that's true. I mean, from the parents' perspective, that's certainly so. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.